Stephen Hussey, thank you for joining me on the Mindful Movement podcast today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I don't know if you remember, but I think we met an event at Bill Schindler's place, Modern Stone Age Kitchen in Chestertown, Maryland. I forgot what the event was, but you were one of the speakers, and that place is a cool place.
Very cool place.
Bill is quite the treasure, for sure. He's also been on the podcast. For those listeners that want to check that out, he wrote a book called Eat Like a Human that is just awesome. I've been diving into your book, Understanding the Heart, Surprising Insights into the Evolutionary Origins of Heart Disease and Why It Matters. So far, it's excellent and it's eye-opening. I think I picked it up after seeing maybe some shorts of yours come across my YouTube feed or maybe Twitter feed or whatever, talking about the heart, kind of upending the idea that how most people think of the heart and the framework we have in our mind. So that made me want to dive deeper. So I was hoping that you could talk about some of those things today. But one thing that stood out is that your background is more chiropractic. So I thought it was, at first glance, it's strange to hear a chiropractor talk about the heart so much. As it said, from the wound comes the gift. And I guess you had quite the wound that led you down this path. You had a heart attack at a pretty young age. Could you start us off by telling us a little bit about that scenario, how old you were, and how this all came about?
Yeah, definitely. My interest in the heart and the vascular system came primarily, or I guess originally, from my diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, which I got at age 9. And I was told, throughout my childhood, going to endocrinologists and lots of different doctors, that it heavily predisposed me to heart disease. I remember seeing the posters on the walls in the doctor's offices, your vascular system is at risk because of higher blood sugars. Because no matter how hard I try, my blood sugars will not be as normal or as stable as someone without type 1, even though mine are pretty darn close. So I was always told that that's going to damage the vascular system. So the small vasculature in the heart and the kidneys and the eyes and the extremities, those types of things are where diabetics get that damage. So I'd always had this interest in heart disease or the vascular system. And so as I went through medical training and just, learning about all kinds of things, health-wise, I'm always, was always paying attention to the heart and the vascular system a bit more. Yeah, at some point I had this collection of information about the heart, and lots of it was very contrary to what I learned, with the typical thinking about the heart is, why it's there, how it functions, but also what causes heart disease. There's lots of information out there very contrary to what the conventional wisdom is about what causes heart disease. And yeah, and then, despite my best efforts, at the age of 34, I had a widowmaker heart attack where a clot developed acutely, very acutely. It wasn't like a slow progression. What people think causes heart attacks, where it's this slow stenosis of an artery, it eventually gets blocked or it ruptures or something. That's not what happens, in my opinion, the vast majority of the time. In my case, I had no plaque in my arteries, whether soft or hard plaque, and that was all confirmed by testing, before the heart attack, and did the angiogram of the heart attack. I had completely clean arteries, and a spontaneous clot formed in my left anterior descending artery, completely blocking the artery, causing a heart attack. And so, yeah, widowmaker heart attacks, they say, statistics are that only 12% of people who have them outside of a hospital setting, having them while they're not hospitalized, they have to get to the hospital, survive them. So I was fortunate. My team did a very good job, or the team that helped me did a very good job. And that's the benefit of Western medicines, that acute emergency situations, they are very, very good at what they do, and they can do some miraculous things. Yeah, the reasons why that happened, I actually did a talk on, it's on my YouTube channel called The Heart Attack Survival Story, about why I think it happened. The main things, just to kind of hit the main points, are I was under probably the most stress I've ever been in my life. In the months prior to that, I was probably chronically dehydrated based on when I look back and think about how I was eating and then how I was not replacing water electrolytes. I do think there was an aspect of what's called oxalate dumping that was happening because I had gone on a very low oxalate diet, and that's around the time when oxalates start dumping. And looking back at your analysis test, there was a lot of oxalates in urine at the time, which I'd never had before. So that can be a very inflammatory thing. And then I heard some very stressful news about a close family member of mine a day and a half before I had the heart attack. So Sunday night, I heard this news, and it wasn't the news in and of itself. It was the inability of me or my family to do anything about getting to this person to help them. We were just sitting and waiting, hoping that it was going to work out and that they would be safe. That was very stressful. So the entire next day, I was stressed thinking about how I could get to this person, but none of us could. And then Tuesday morning, woke up and unwisely did this news and just all the stress and everything I was under. And I, like 15, 20 minutes after I did that workout, yeah, and my heart and my workouts were very intense at that time. And so the story, because I had all this information about the heart in my head, and I have probably 100% more than I did at the time that I had this heart attack, because I've delved in even deeper. But I guess the moral of the story is that, like I said, you know, like in an emergency situation, they saved my life, and I'm very grateful for them, for Western medicine. But there comes a point that as soon as someone gets through an emergency, becomes stable, the hospital is like the best place for them to be in that emergency. And then as soon as they're stable, it becomes the worst place for them to be as far as healing. You know, if you look at the environment that a hospital is and how contrary to what it is to the stimuli that provide healing to the body, it is the absolute worst place for healing, which is a fundamental misunderstanding or lack of understanding about what it takes for a body to heal. And so in my investigations of the heart and heart disease, you know, I've kind of found those things and I'm working to share them, because I completely healed my heart without doing almost any of the things that the medical profession recommended, because I knew that they were wrong. I knew that they would lead me right back there to the hospital and lead most people right back there. And so I'm trying to share that story because people, unfortunately, are going to be in that situation, the same one I was in. And so if they don't have all the information, how are they supposed to make educated decisions? The decision is theirs, whatever they decide to do. But there's way more information than what is provided by Western medicine. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Stephen, that is awesome. You mentioned the word environment a moment ago, and it reminded me of something that stuck out early in your book about how one of the, I don't want to say the role, but one of the like relationships we have with our environment is to essentially extract energy or create energy from what we could extract from it. One way, you know, we think about food, you know, the food we intake is part of our environment, and it's got a bunch of stored energy in it and chemical bonds that we could like potentiate or act on by breaking them down and turning them into electrical energy. And there are other environmental components that play a role of our ability to create energy, thrive, that are definitely not on people's mind when they think about. I'm looking forward to learning more about that. But I guess first, if we could, before that step, would be to explain a little bit about the heart itself. I guess it's just not the pump that we think it is. Can you elaborate on that idea?
Yeah, reading a lot of research about the heart for probably, you know, almost my entire adult life, I came across a lot of evidence. And this is not just theories. This is, you know, if you want to, you know, dictate what you think about things through research, like there's lots of research from the very, you know, the very first person who described the heart and cardiovascular system had doubts that the heart was what was moving the blood. So when you read all this and you realize how much of it there is, you start to realize that we've completely misunderstood what the role of the heart in the body is. And, you know, if you look at it and you see this contracting organ and you see blood coming out of it and you see blood moving around the body, you think, oh, yeah, that's what the job of the heart is. However, there is a lot of literature that suggests that it's impossible for a heart the size of ours, of a human's, to be able to effectively move blood throughout the entire body and be the only reason that it moves. And, you know, medical schools, they learn like, oh, yeah, well, moving your body, like contracting your muscles helps the blood move. And the veins have one-way valve so that they can't go back the way it came. And all that stuff is important as well. But the main way the blood moves is not through a contracting heart, forcefully pumping it around the body. And there are lots of studies that show that if we looked at the heart as a pressure propulsion pump, that it would be about 15% efficient. And that's, you know, whether you believe we were created by someone or we evolved, that's not, you know, a very efficient way to create someone or for evolution to have chose that path.
When you say 15% efficient, do you mean the power that it puts out is only 15% of what it would take to move that much fluid through that much?
In that study, they looked at the amount of energy used and amount of fluid moved. So based on the amount of energy that is used by the heart, they're saying that it's only 15% efficient at moving fluid.
So it'd be a wasteful way for Mother Nature to devise this structure. would make sense.
Like 100% of our energy is only moving 50% of the fluid if you look at it as a pressure propulsion pump. However, if you look at it as what I've started to call a vortexing hydraulic ram, then it makes way more sense and what the role is. So there are three functions of the heart, three roles of the heart in the body. Being the main mover of blood is not one of them. It does do a little bit of moving, but no more moving blood, but it's no more than enough to get the blood through the chambers of the heart itself. There's no way it could push it all around the body. And they've shown that. Like, they've done experimental models where they tried to recreate the vascular system with a pressure propulsion pump as a heart, and they couldn't do it. They couldn't, like, it didn't work. The hydraulics of the system just didn't work. They couldn't keep the venous side especially open with enough pressure.
I think you also mentioned in your book there was an experiment where I don't know if it was on a human, but after a body was dead, the blood was still moving for quite some time after that, even though the heart wasn't pumping.
Right, yeah. They did experiments in the 40s with Thompson, and then in the 60s they were repeated by a guy named Leon, who might even try to pronounce his last name. He's a Dutch guy, where they at first it was in dogs they did this. And so, yes, when the dog's heart stopped, the blood continued to move for up to 2 hours after the heart stopped.
Did they have a hypothesis back then or explanation?
No, they didn't. Leon, the Dutch scientist, said that he believed that the heart was not the main mover, obviously, but he didn't believe that the blood had its own motor energy, is what he called it. It's kind of true, but it's kind of not, which we're going to talk about. But yeah, so lots of experiments putting this into doubt. And even recently, they've shown in Dr. Gerald Pollack's lab that in a chick embryo, when you stop the heart of the chick embryo, the blood continues to move. After that, they have actual visual videos of this where they show that it continues to move. It kind of, like, you stop the heart and the blood kind of stops and kind of reverses because the pressure changes a little bit, and then it keeps going. It continues to go. The way the blood moves is because our bodies are filled of what's called structured water. Well, they're filled with water. We're all told we're whatever percentage, large percentage water, up to 80%, depending on who you read. But most of that water in the body is in a gel state. It's kind of like Jell-O or the consistency of raw egg white. You know, it's because we're told that there's solid, liquid, gas forms of water. There's actually this gel state too. It's called the fourth phase of water. And so, like, if I take the tissue in my forearm, you know, I can move it and it goes just, it moves just like a gel, and then it bounces right back just like a gel, right? So most of the water in my body is a gel. But there are places in the body where it's still liquid, like in lymphatic fluid, cerebrospinal fluid, and in the blood. The blood is about half liquid water. But that water can become this gel-like water on the lining of the arteries, because in order for structured water to form, it needs water, the raw material. It needs energy, mainly in the form of infrared light, but we can get it in many forms of energy. And it needs a biological surface or a water-loving surface, which all biological surfaces are. And so this water in the blood can structure itself and become more like a gel. This gel-like water has some very unique properties. All of these properties are outlined in the book, The Fourth Phase of Water, by Dr. Gerald Pollack. One of the properties is that because of the way the structured water forms, and where, like, you have oxygen and two hydrogens of water, one of the hydrogens is cleaved off, and you have an oxygen and hydrogen left, and then those oxygens and hydrogens team up with other oxygens and hydrogens, and they form like this lattice-like, honeycomb-looking structures that kind of line up on top of each other on that hydrophilic surface. And that's the layer of gel water. But because it's not a balanced molecule anymore, because it's not two hydrogens balancing out the bigger oxygen, it's one oxygen and one hydrogen comparatively, then the bigger oxygen is very electronegatively charged, which makes structured water very negatively charged. So it's got this very negatively charged area. And because those hydrogens that were cleaved off are very positive and they line up next to that structured water, then we have a negative area next to a positive area. And that is an energy gradient. That's a battery, a charge separation, which is why when we see on batteries, there's a positive and negative end, that we put it in the appropriate way so that energy can flow between the two. And so basically, that is the energy storage of our body is in structured water. And it can do work, and the energy can be used to do work. And in the case of the blood vessels and the blood, it actually does the work of moving fluid. And they've done this over and over again in Dr. Pollack's lab, where you put a hydrophilic tube in water and you shine infrared light, energizing the water. It forms a structure of water on the inner lining of the tube, and the water starts to flow through the tube with no pump acting on it whatsoever. And this is what they show with the chick embryos in their vascular system, that they stop the heart. And the blood, you know, kind of reversed a little bit, and then it continued to move in the same direction. And if they put infrared light on the embryo, it moved even faster. This is how the blood moves for the most part.
That is wild. Can I pause you for a second? Okay, so a water-liking surface, hydrophilic container that's holding water that without the energy would be still, still, it's infused with energy, which creates one of the molecules to break off the H2O, which creates some kind of gradient between charges. So you're saying the charge on the oxygen, because it's bigger, isn't balanced out by the hydrogen. So there's a differential that creates some kind of action, but that's created with infrared light. Doesn't our body produce infrared light? Aren't we? So we're taking water and making it structured.
We get infrared light from the sun, which is why this makes sense evolutionarily, because the sun is the ultimate source of infrared light. And then, yes, our bodies, our mitochondria do emit infrared light.
How do you know how that compares from a power intensity, what we make compared to what we get sun? Like, does one of those carry more weight?
Sunlight. Definitely. We need to be out in the sun. That's the energy source for all life on the planet. And it's why all life is here. We need the sun. However, our mitochondria, so like whenever we're harvesting, you know, the energy, the form of electrons from like breaking down food and harvesting from that, when the electrons are transported and dropped down, they're emitting light. And that light is called ultra weak biophoton emission, which people can check out Roland Bonwick's book on that, which is very dense, but it's probably the best source of literature on ultra weak biophoton emission. And that is the light, the infrared light. So if you put on like electron or infrared goggles, person lights up like a Christmas tree, right? Because we're emitting infrared light. So yes, we can be a source of our infrared light, but we also need it from external sources as well.
Do you know, I know this is a little bit off topic, but like I have a sauna and it has a bunch of different infrared. I think they're lumped as like far, mid, or near. Do you know if one of those categories of infrared has more of an action on the structuring?
Yeah, so technically far infrared, on the far, which is the farthest end of the spectrum of light from the sun, you know, far infrared all the way through UV with the colors of light in the middle, you know, but the far infrared, according to Dr. Pollack and research he's done in his lab, is the most structuring to water. It will create the most exclusion zone, fourth phase water, whatever you want to call it, structured water in the body, specifically the 3000 nanometer wavelength, which is the farthest of the far infrared. But you don't have to get, but I don't know of a sauna that makes something that emits 3000, but you can get close to that and you can get far infrared more than, but you know, near infrared, red light, all the different colors of light, they'll all do it. Like water can absorb all these wavelengths of energy. It's just that far infrared builds the structured water the best. So yeah, but that makes sense too, because all the colors of light come from the sun. So does infrared, so does UV. All this stuff is good for us. And it's mainly good for us because water can absorb it and use it to, you know, hold charge in the body and then do the work of the body, whether that's cellular work, moving a fluid, whatever.
So does blood flow, if the structuring of the water is creating this ability for blood to move on its own, is it the more structured or the more infrared light, the faster your blood moves? Is that inherently...
That's what they've shown, at least in the lab, the more infrared you put on the system, then the faster it moves. So like in those chick embryos, like they continued to move without the infrared exposure because there was some stored up energy there. But then when they put infrared on the chick embryos after they stopped the heart, more structured water forms. So if you think about a tube and it's got these layers of structured water on it around the outside, if you increase those layers, the amount of space for the water to flow gets smaller. So that creates quicker flow. Just like if I put my thumb over the end of a hose and create the less space, it comes out faster. Same kind of thing.
Does the heart rate react to that flow rate or that level of structured? Like is... For instance, would a low heart rate be an indication of a lack of structure because the heart's just kind of going along with what the environment has? It's not trying to overpower the current conditions by speeding everything up? Or does a high heart rate indicate like things are moving really well?
Not necessarily. There's lots of different things that can, you know, dictate what determines heart rate. One is, you know, signaling to the heart from the nervous system, from the brain, which is all from signals you're getting from your environment. Like if you're in a stressful environment, then your body picks up that stress, relays it to the brain. Brain tells the heart to beat faster, that kind of stuff. So that can play a role in it. But also, if you're getting that stress signal, your blood vessels are constricting, which is increasing flow rate, which the heart then has to keep up with because the blood is flowing into the heart instead of the heart creating flow. And so if there's increased flow, then the heart has to speed up to respond to that. You know, having lower heart rate is an indication that maybe your nervous system is really balanced, but it's not necessarily an indication of how structured your water is, because your body will structure and unstructure the water as needed based on what it's trying to do. There's lots of different components of a heartbeat, you know, or heart rate.
Are there any other processes within the body that aren't reliant on the external factors or environmental factors that also contribute to the structuring?
What do you mean? Like, is there things that destroy the structured water?
Like, I know so our mitochondria make a little water in the process of metabolism, and that water is structured. Are there any other things that go on in the body that are not like triggered but not by environmental stuff that have an impact on how much structuring is going on? Like if somebody was two people were getting the same amount of light exposure, would other factors internally dictate how well the structuring is taking place in their vascular system?
No, not necessarily. I mean, mitochondrial health is really important, and some people have varying levels of that depending on their lifestyle. So that kind of stuff could affect it. But like people get like, if there's water there, there's a hydrophilic surface and you get sunlight, water's going to structure itself. You know, it's going to happen. That's what water wants to do next to a biological surface. Like I said, like there's things that can interfere with that. So especially in your cells, if your mitochondria are not functioning well, you're not making enough ATP. ATP is not unfolding proteins. If you don't have enough of it, it's not unfolding proteins in the cell. And that's reduced, making less surface area, which means less biological surfaces for structured water to form. So that is something that you got to pay attention to. And that's, you know, what poor mitochondrial health is. But there's lots of things that create poor mitochondrial health. It's not just diet, but it's circadian rhythm. It's environmental toxins, lots of different things, stress, EMFs, all kinds of things that can affect mitochondrial function.
Gotcha. Yeah, that would be a whole other conversation. Other than for the environmental factors then, other than light primarily from the sun, I think you referenced grounding in the book and that playing a role. We've talked about grounding on this podcast before. From what I understand, it, among other things, it's essentially an exchange of electrons we're getting from the earth when it comes into contact with our body. How does that factor in? Is it just that added charge that we're getting that influences that?
If people are dieting now more than ever, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs, or medium-chain triglycerides, are unique compounds that can be easily converted into ketones and provide an efficient fuel source for your body, thereby enhancing your energy production potential. Instead of turning into fat when you consume them, MCTs turn into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. MCT Wellness is Dr. Gundry's polyphenol-rich MCT powder aimed at boosting your body's fat-burning capacity. What's amazing is this energy boost can be felt quickly. It doesn't take months or years to make a difference. It's also very easy to add to your routine. There are 3 great flavors to choose from, and you just add a scoop of MCT Wellness to some water or your favorite drink and enjoy. So if you want to experience a quick and effective boost to your metabolic potential, go to GundryMD.com/mindful and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular priced order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/mindful.
Separation of those water molecules?
Yeah, so it's basically energy. You want to energize water. That's what you're trying to do. So energy is electrons. Like electricity in the wall is electrons supposedly passing down this wire in the wall, coming out the socket to charge whatever you want to charge or to power whatever you want to power.
Supposedly. You say that like a skeptic.
Well, I just heard different theories that it's not, that the electrons are not actually traveling down, that they're actually just moving back and forth really quick, and that's creating energy. So again, it's all just theories. even like the theory of relativity is a theory, you know, where we explain different things that we see. They're all just theories, but there's different theories as to how what's actually happening. All we can really know for sure is that when we do this, we see this and it happens. Okay.
So electrons from the Earth are creating an energy source, and really any energy source could create the structuring process.
Everything on the planet, all life on the planet is just trying to get energy. That's all it is. And then it's trying to store it in structured water. That's how we store this negative energy. We're trying to get electrons, which are negatively charged, and that is stored in a negatively charged water, which is what's stored in a plant. It's what the ocean is. It's what all life is. We're on a water planet. Water is the thing that does that. And so we can get electrons in many different ways. So can plants and other animals. One is we can absorb them directly from the earth. Those electrons come from the sun, because the sun concentrates energy into the ionosphere. And then when that gets excited during a thunderstorm, it strikes the earth as lightning, and it deposits electrons into the earth. And then we can, through the laws of electrostatics, conduct that energy into us. We can get energy directly from sunlight exposure, the DHA and the melanin in our skin and in our bodies. Can take sunlight and directly create electrons from it. And so that's how that happens. And then that is stored again in water and used in the mitochondria. Those electrons are used in mitochondria to make cellular metabolic water. So that's one of the byproducts of mitochondria. We can also create electricity by gently stretching or compressing fascia. Fascia is hydrated with a layer of structured water. Yeah, there's many different ways that we gain energy. We can harvest the bonds directly from food and gain electrons from that, but that's kind of an inefficient way. It's not the most productive way to do it. So when we think about energetic requirements, I like to think of it as, there's scientists that say about a third of our energy should come from food or can come from food. The rest needs to come from our environment. And then nutrients we need to get from food. So that's protein, vitamins, and minerals. So when I think about food, it's like, is there an energy source and is there enough protein, vitamins, and minerals? That's what eating should be about, is getting those things. All life on Earth is trying to harvest energy from the environment in many different ways. And that's what maintains health. If you maintain that energy and that net negative charge of the body, which is held in structured water, you have a very high chance of achieving health. Cardiovascular health, any type of health. If you start to lose that charge because you've removed yourself from these environments that give your body energy and charge, we start to get disease. We start to get disorder. And that can manifest itself in many different ways depending on the person and where they're susceptible.
That's wild. You mentioned in your case, it was not like a chronic, slow build. They showed no plaque in your arteries. It was like an acute event, you said. Has there been any experiments where someone that has accumulated some measurable plaque has able to reduce that by focusing on improving their like status of structured?
Well, no, there hasn't been. I did that personally, which that's a whole nother story. Yeah, no, because in Western medicine and most Western researchers don't even really acknowledge structured water. You know, unless your name is Gerald Pollack and other scientists like Gilbert Lang and Albert Szent-Györgyi and Mei-Hwan Ho and lots of different scientists that have looked into water, then you're pretty ignorant about it as far as the effects of structured water. So there's no like study with it. I mean, Dr. Pollack has told me or researchers in his lab have told me that atherosclerosis is one thing that they're looking at. Or they're going to look at, it's on their list to look at the effects of structured water on that. But, you know, heart disease, atherosclerosis, a stroke, a heart attack, the end result is clotting. Atherosclerosis is clotting tissue. It's not an accumulation of cholesterol. When you analyze atherosclerosis, it's clotting tissue, which clotting tissue is the same thing that forms when you cut your skin and you get a scab. That's clotting tissue. So it's the same type of thing on there. And if we want to prevent clotting, we need to do three things, according to Rudolf Virchow back in 1856, said that these are the three things that induce clotting, and that still holds true in medicine today. Damage to the lining of the artery, poor or stagnant blood flow, and when elements of blood stick together. And the thing that protects the lining of the artery is structured water on the lining of the artery. The thing that makes blood flow, we've already talked about, is structured water on the lining of the artery. And then structured water also forms on the elements of blood. like the red blood cells, lipoproteins, because they're also biological hydrophilic surfaces. And so when structured water forms around them, they become electronegatively charged because it has structured water. And so negatively or like charged things don't like to be next to each other. They repel each other. And so that keeps it, right? They're less sticky. And so that prevents them from coagulating because clotting.
That's interesting. I remember seeing, cut you off there. I remember seeing when I was diving into the whole grounding literature that there'd be images. I forget the type of imaging, I don't know how to say the word, where they're looking at blood cells, like in real time. That's where you would see a difference. You would see the cells stick together. And then after some given amount of time, 20 minutes maybe of grounding, like they would separate. So you're saying it's the fact that they have, it's almost like they have when you're repelling same side of magnets or something, like you get that charge and then they're pushing away from each other. So they have more space.
They're attracted to the positively charged fluid in that is blood because those hydrogens are positively charged and they're all out in the medium of the blood. But the elements of blood, all the proteins, red blood cells, lipoproteins, everything should have structured water around it. And when it does, it's kind of attracted to the positive charged fluid in the blood, but then it gets too close to one another and they repel. They stay evenly spaced. And so if you get like an erythrocyte sedimentation rate, that's a measure of how likely or how readily your red blood cells clump together. And so you don't want that to be fast. You don't want that to happen fast.
Can you say that word again? The
erythrocyte, which is just a red blood cell, sedimentation rate. ESR is how the test is.
That's a test. Can anybody get that test? Or?
Yeah, you could. It's a blood test. But, you know, that just tells you at that snapshot in time what ESR is. So that could be completely different. You know, you take that test while you're outside in the sun grounded, that test is going to look awesome. But you immediately go inside under artificial light away from the earth and you take it 5 minutes later, it could look terrible. So it fluctuates pretty drastically. So yeah, like a test, one snapshot in time is not going to tell you, oh, I'm good, because it changes moment to moment.
Does artificial light, I mean, you mentioned all light can structure water. I hear so many negative things about artificial light and light hygiene. Is that structuring water, though? Is that helping us in some way, even though it might be hurting us in other ways? Or
The problem with artificial light is that it's processed light. So it's very high in blue and it's low in the other colors. But it's supposed to be pretty evenly balanced or more evenly balanced than that. We're supposed to get a full spectrum. That's why the sun is white light. It has all the colors of light. And so there's studies that show that blue light can help with arterial health and that kind of stuff, but always at real world doses, which means like we're only supposed to have primarily blue light during the day. And even then at solar noon, which is not always noon, is when blue light is highest. But it's always balanced, very well balanced with the other colors of light. And that's what the study shows, is that within the context of being balanced, blue light is good for us. But if it's unbalanced and blue light from a light bulb is up here and all the other colors are down here, that is damaging. And they've shown that damages the photoreceptors in the eye, damages the photoreceptors on the skin. That makes it hard for our body to then absorb light in better ways. And so, yeah, then there's the whole circadian rhythm conversation and how that's disruptive to circadian rhythm. But in and of itself, blue light is harmful in other ways besides disruption of circadian rhythm. So we always want to try and get full spectrum light, whether that's from the sun or full spectrum light bulbs or just better lighting in the house, open the windows and not turn on bulbs, whatever.
It's a process to just look at, to analyze your light hygiene or whatever you want to call it and try to make incremental changes. Some things are just, it's like you try to do what you can do, be healthy. And some things they could be overwhelming. They're rabbit holes that are just like, where do I begin? There's so much. I mean, EMS is one of them. Light is one of them, but I do think it makes a difference.
It's very important. And like, you know, our modern society has set us up in a way that makes it difficult to do these things. But the message that needs to be heard loud and clear is that you can't, like when you learn that information, you need to understand that this is what's making us sick. These things, you know, maybe not only EMF or not only the wrong light environment or not only the poor diet. There's lots of different things, but these are what's making us sick. Until you start to correct those things, then your body's not going to express health to its fullest extent. Even if you just change your diet drastically and you go on a low carb whatever, you change your diet and you see all these improvements in health, that's awesome. It worked, you know, but that's not the only thing that's going to do it. We have to change the environment. You can't just take a supplement and be healthy. You can't just take a medication and be healthy. All those things are not going to work unless we change our environment, because your body does not want to be unhealthy. It's trying to be healthy, but it's just receiving signals from its environment and interpreting those accordingly and then responding. And if you're responding in a way of being unhealthy, then you have to change your environment. And it has to be more than just taking a supplement or taking a pill or changing your diet. Like, it has to be everything. And look at all the signals of your body. And that's hard. And so it is a process. I didn't just wake up one day and live the way I live today. You know, it took years for me to get there. And for me, I was trying to learn. There's a lot of trial and error. You know, and so I like to be able to help people, that give them direction, speed up that process for them, even though I realize that they're not going to wake up tomorrow and do the things that I do. It's going to be a process. You just got to keep going the right direction, keep making steps, do one thing at a time, and just recognize that you have to get to the end if you want to live that, you know, life. You know, the last 20 years of your life, you don't want them to be in poor health if you want to be living your best life, you know. Yeah, there's no lymphatic pump. There's no lymphatic heart. It has to move somehow, and that is through these mechanisms, yeah.
I think that's also helped along, from what I understand, through breathing and muscular contraction. But I guess that's kind of like what the heart's doing. It's helping it along. It's helping the blood flow along, but it's not like this big primary driver.
No, the blood is only moving, the heart's only moving the blood through the chambers of the heart. It's not really helping the blood along when it gets into the periphery.
So it's only making enough power to move the blood from one end of the heart to the other?
Not even that necessarily. It helps with that. But like if your ejection fraction was 100%, then that would be the case, that your heart is forcefully ejecting all the blood out and that kind of stuff. But it's only, I mean, normal is like 50 to 70%. Yeah, so but what the heart's job is to vortex the blood. So the heart is a vortex, which means it creates spiral motions of the blood. It like water tornadoes, you know, it swirls the blood around, because that's one way that water can hold energy. If it's swirled around or swished around in the presence of oxygen, then that energizes the water to an extent, and that's what the heart is doing. If you look at when blood flows into a chamber of the heart, it vortexes. The heart, when it contracts, it spirals. That's why it's shaped like a football on one end, not a basketball. So it contracts at the spiral like nature, and that vortexes the blood. So the heart is a vortex. So that is helping energize the water. So when it gets into the periphery, it can more readily form structured water and get the blood moving. So the heart helps with movement of blood in that sense, but it is not forcefully pumping. And maybe you do a little bit of pumping, again, like enough to move 15% of the blood, but it's vortexing, right? That's why there's many chambers, so that it's going in and out of chambers and getting moved around and swished around, so that it, because when it gets into the blood, it's laminar flow, which is just straight, which is not very energizing to blood. But if you think about it, the reason that makes sense is because water on the planet is never sitting still. It's always being moved. We have tidal currents. We have waves crashing on the beach. We have water flowing over rocks and waterfalls and rivers. We have evaporation and precipitation of water. Like, it's moving. It's not stagnant. And that's because that's what puts energy into water, is when we move it, when the earth moves it. So it has to be the same in us. We can't have stagnant blood flow. We've got to create motion. We got to mix it around, you know?
Is it worth swirling your drink before you swig it?
If your water is dead, yes. If your water has come through laminar pipes, then yeah. But you could put it in the sun, too. You could put it close to the earth, and there's devices that mimic the electromagnetic field of the earth that you put your water on. And again, this all makes sense because it's what nature does. You know, sunlight is hitting the water. The water is next to the earth. The water is moving. So it makes sense.
It's what I do. I'll go out and I'll bring a clear glass water bottle, and I'll do some exercise outside barefoot in the sun. And I'll make sure that my water is sitting in the sun, and I swirl it before I swig in hopes that it's doing something. But I don't know if it's just being silly.
Especially if it's low toxin water and high mineral status. I mean, again, that's the way it is in nature. That's the way it's supposed to be in us. We start putting these things in to interfere with that process. We start to get disease. The water is not what it should be, you know, and that's what we're made of, is water.
Do we know how long it holds? So let's say you have a swirl it. I've even seen those things for sale that like swirl your water for you, carafe or something. But if you swirl it for a given amount of time, and let's say you have light on it and then you stop, you say it stores it. Do we know how long it could hold that?
For a pretty long while, unless there's a stimulus from the outside that destroys that. So artificial light would not be great. We want full spectrum light, sunlight on it. Electromagnetic fields would do that. They would destroy the energy, you know, that kind of stuff. Or laminar flow, just it moving through a tube, straight through a tube rather than being switched around. Like, I don't have like an exact time of when, but yeah, it would stay there a pretty good while. I want to say 4 hours. I don't know why that's popping into my head. Maybe because I read it somewhere in a research.
Okay, so Stephen, the heart does not pump; it vortexes and then helps us with this structuring process along with these environmental stimuli. Charge that our blood gets from that structured nature, things move along so that everything could do its job. So we could move nutrients and oxygen around and utilize it and have all the functions of our structure unfold. Any other parts to that system that you think are worth talking about before we get into what do we do?
Yeah, I mean, so what's important to realize is that, and this segues right into what we can do or what we should do, but what's important to note is that, you know, the heart is a vortexing hydraulic ram, so it does create this vortex that helps energize the water, but it is not enough to do it on its own. Like, your body needs external stimuli, which again makes sense because that's the environment that humans were in, you know, since, you know, life, and then pre-humans and humans had been in, they were outside in the sun. So why would the heart evolve to be the only way that we create this blood flow, right? Or the energy we get to create this blood flow? It couldn't. If we lived in a cave, you know, out of the sun, or weren't on this earth or whatever, then we would evolve differently. But it didn't. So we need that environmental stimuli too. And so that's why if we remove ourselves from that and we get poor mitochondrial health, people can develop heart failure, which is when the blood is not moving very well through the periphery and it's getting pulled up in the heart, making it expand and extend, making it, when it contracts, do more pumping than it's really supposed to do, putting strain on the heart. And then we start to get, you know, fluid built up in areas of the body. We start to get edema, can back up in the lungs, make it hard to breathe, and all this kind of stuff. Like, so the heart failure is a misnomer because it's not the heart that's failing. It's the movement of mechanisms that move blood that is failing, making the heart, putting the heart under strain.
I got a question. You mentioned the importance of the sun. Wouldn't there be a signal that people that live farther from the equator would have higher rates of heart disease? Or is that like more than compensated because they're generally live a healthier lifestyle? Or,
I mean, there's so many factors today. Just because somebody lives further from the equator doesn't mean that they're doing any certain thing because of our modern way of life, because of indoor living and all this kind of stuff. And just because someone lives at the equator doesn't mean that they're living in any certain way. You know, but, and just because, and like, you know, infrared is always present when the sun is up. So yes, you may be getting way less in the winter at a more northern latitude because you just get less sunlight. You know, we get really short days. But there's a reason that humans and life evolved at the equator, you know, very around the equator, because there was lots of sun. But even when the sun comes up, you're getting tons of infrared light. No matter what time of year it is, where you are on the planet, when the sun is up, you're getting lots of infrared. Like when the sun rises, it's very high in red and infrared, and then slowly there's higher in red and infrared than the other colors. But then over the day, then the rest of the colors come up higher, and then they come back down when the sun sets. But infrared's always there. So,
all right, so what's the equation? What do you do as someone that clearly thinks about this a lot, values your health? You know, one thing is the way people value their health when it's been taken from them changes. Oh, you got a visitor behind you.
He likes to photobomb things.
What's your approach, like, when you're looking at how to compose the minutes of your day to optimize these things that you learned?
I mean, I guess, though, the underlining thing is get your body in contact with things that gives your body energy. So that could be a very metabolically flexible diet that I think is generally lower in carbohydrate, higher in animal foods, probably the best diet for humans, because historically that's what was available. Plants are only available one time a year for, you know, a certain amount of time.
But not around the equator. So if we evolved from there.
technically, yeah, you would get more plants in that area, and you could, but that's a whole other story. I'll get into that. But you know, more northern latitudes, than animal foods were always been around. Even at the equator, animal foods are around. So the idea animal foods are bad for us is completely wrong, and it's probably actually the best food for humans as far as nutrient density and bioavailability of those nutrients, because that's what nutrition should really be focused about, is getting nutrients, adequate nutrients, which is why I love Bill Schindler, because he's always talking about how humans ate historically to maximize the amount of nutrients you got from food, whether it was animal or plants.
But energy too. We're trying to get energy from our environment. Like fruits hold a lot of that energy. Like things that hold sugars, is a lot of energy stored. And is the water in a fruit?
Yeah, the water in an animal. So the fresher your food, the better. You're going to get water that's already energized. But you know, whether or not that stays energized in your body, it depends on the environment that it's in. And yes, like, so fat and carbohydrates do hold energy. However, when we talk about ATP, which unfolds proteins and allows us to hold our charge, we're going to get way more ATP made from fat than we are from glucose or fructose or whatever type of carbohydrate.
I've heard different things about that. And I don't know what's true. Because I used to think that for a long time. Because we learn that fat has 9 calories of potential energy in a gram compared to, let's say, 4 of a gram of carbohydrate. So I used to think, well, that's obviously more efficient. And then I learned that there's that it's kind of the wrong framework, and that the more relevant question is, if you had unlimited fat or unlimited, let's say, glucose, question is, what makes more ATP over a fixed period of time?
That's the more important thing, because looking at the kilocalories is like an energetic thing. But if you run a mitochondria on glucose, you get 36, one molecule of glucose, you get 36 ATP at the end of that. If you run a one molecule of fat, you get 4 times as much.
But that's per molecule. We're on a continuum of time. So if you're running more through the mitochondria, if you're revving the engine higher with the sugar, with the glucose, do you make more given fixed?
Well, maybe, but you're also creating a lot more nitrogen and oxygen free radicals, which is not what you want. You need those things as signaling molecules, but they're also stealing your charge when you do that. So you want an efficient system that has less waste product. That is fat, for sure. Also, this is the conversation I was going to have earlier, like if you're eating plant foods, you're getting a lot of deuterium, especially fruit. It's a deuterium bomb. And deuterium is an isotope of hydrogen that clogs up your mitochondria and makes them not work properly. In order to get rid of deuterium, you need sunlight. That's why plant foods are available in environments that are higher in sun, or only in environments where the sun, or only in times of the year where the sun is out more, because you eat them during sunny times, so you can deal with that deuterium. But if you're eating these plant foods all year round, especially in a place where it gets cold, you're just clogging up your mitochondria, creating poor metabolic health. It's more than just biochemistry, and we have to acknowledge that. And so it's the light signaling combined with what we're metabolizing, fat or carbohydrate. And that's not to say that we should never have carbohydrates, because they're obviously available in nature. It's select times of year in most places, unless you live in a very sunny climate. There's also something to be said about mitochondrial haplotype and like where your ancestors came from and what type of mitochondria you have and how well they become uncoupled in times of colder climates versus warmer ones. There's lots of different factors.
So, there's a case to at least eat seasonably and to consider the framework of where your people are from. But that's also a rabbit hole too, because it's like, when do you stop looking back? Do you look at where your people were 1,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, million years ago?
I would say look at your ancestry, before the changes in modern way of life that we've seen. So that is processed food, processed light.
But why? Why stop there? If you're looking at answer, like, why stop there and not go back to...
Then you're distracting yourself. Yeah, and you're interfering with your ability to move forward. That's why.
So, yeah, that's a whole other conversation with a lot of nuance. So, metabolically flexible diet.
Sunlight. You got to get in the sun, you have to get in contact with the earth. So, get outside.
How do you approach that? What is your, strategy to get what you feel is enough sun for you?
So, I'm pretty fair-skinned. I'm from Northern European ancestry. If I didn't work on it, I would burn pretty easily. But burning is not, I mean, it's bad for you in that it causes damage immediately at that time, but it's not going to cause any disease process any more than cutting your skin is going to cause a disease process in the long run. What causes damage is imbalanced light. So there's plenty of, you know, studies that show that the lower amounts of UVB you get, the higher your rates of skin cancer risk. Or there's studies that show that people with skin cancer, the more UVB they get, the less they die from skin cancer, having melanoma already. There's studies that show that too much UVA light without vitamin D, which we get from UVB exposure, is what's causing, is creating the imbalances that lead to skin cancer. When what does that is modern windows. You know, modern windows filter out UVB and they let UVA in, more UVA in. So living indoors, again, is creating imbalances.
This is what I mean by it can be overwhelming. Like, everybody's got windows in their house.
But how is it overwhelming? Like, the answer, go back to where humans came from. You don't have to know the details that I just told you. It's very simple. Like, we had disease, right? Or we didn't have disease, I mean. And then 100 years, the last 100 years, especially the last 100 years, 150 years, we've gotten so sicker. Like, really. I mean, and you could argue that agriculture 10,000 years ago, when that started, we started seeing new diseases. But it wasn't until the last 150 years. And what changed? Industrial Revolution, lots of toxic chemicals, processed food diets. We went from eating primarily animal foods and foods in season to being able to eat whatever we want and eating processed foods. And then in 1950, we got fluorescent lights. 1970, we got LED lights. That's what changed. Those are the things. So then it's simple. You don't have to know the details. It's just common sense. Like, okay, go back to what we were doing. Within the context of your modern way of life, just try and get as much sunlight as you can. Try and minimize your artificial light exposure. Eat whole foods, you know, regardless of what way or you choose to eat. You don't have to be dogmatic about it. Just eat whole foods. Avoid toxin exposure. You know, do the best you can. And then keep trying to get to better levels of health. Do the best you can. And then don't worry about the things you can't control right now and try and get to a place where you can't control them. That's the answer. You know, I like the details. I like the things. I like to know that kind of stuff and be able to show people, because some people like that. They want to have that evidence, you know. But that's the simple. You don't have to overwhelm yourself. Just, it's inherently logical. Like, just go back to where we came from and your body's probably going to feel a lot better.
Yeah, I agree. Most of our issues come from like a departure from what was natural, what we did for a long time, which also makes you wonder, like, if we keep up these crap things that are bad for us now for, I mean, I don't know if humans will make it this long, but what adaptations will we do like over the next million years if we're still here to account for that? Like, by then, maybe getting light through your window in your house is better for you because we'll create structures to help us survive with that environment.
Not fast enough, no.
Probably not.
We can't evolve that fast. It takes at least 30 generations, and that's very select breeding, 30 generations, which is way too long compared to how fast things have changed.
You get you're getting as much sun as you can and interfering with that process, you know, within reason. I mean, you're saying burning's not necessarily the end of the world, but it's not something to be encouraged, I assume.
However, so here's the thing. If you stay inside all winter, you know, and don't tell your body, and your circadian rhythm is way off, which means you're not signaling your body when day and night is, and you're not getting that signal throughout the season, and you're not getting out in the morning and telling your body when there's less intense light. And then the first time it's warm in the season, you go out at noon and you're just like, yeah, then it's like, of course you're going to burn. Like, you have your body is totally off. So, you know, like, I'm pretty tan right now for my fair skin. And it's because I sync my body up to the day and night cycle. And I do that throughout the seasons. You know, I saw sunlight this morning, so I could go out at noon and sit out there for an hour, hour and a half and not burn. When historically I would probably have third degree burns on me if I did that you know, without doing those types of things. So what is it? Is it the sun is bad for us and that we burn, or is it that we're just totally, you know, disconnected from the sun and the natural day-night cycle, and that's what's making us burn? Plus, DHA, which is a fatty acid molecule that's found primarily in seafood but also in most animal foods, that is what allows us to take sunlight, or one thing that allows us to take sunlight and convert that to energy. There's some evidence that shows that when we build our skin with, you know, and omega-6 fats rather than the omega-3s like DHA, that we burn more. So if we make up our skin cells are made up of primarily vegetable oils and these plant fats, then we can absorb sunlight. And so what happens? Our skin gets damaged. Rather than transforming it into, energy, it just burns our skin. So diet plays a role in it too. There's reasons that we're burning and we're intolerant to sun.
Yeah, I used to burn a lot as a kid, and now I don't. I go out every morning that the sun is there, hit my lawn, I get probably 20, 30 minutes, and then midday I try to get a good 30 to 60 minutes, and then I usually go for an after-dinner walk and during sunset or something. And that's been a good recipe for me. It'll burn. And I definitely have noticed that I really think that the changing of my diet and reducing those polyunsaturated fatty acids, those omega-6s, have had an impact, because I seem to like not be able to burn. Even when I fall asleep midday in the sun, I ought to be burned, but I'm not. And granted, I have a tolerance. Like, I think there's something to be said to building a tolerance slowly, like early season conditioning, and then you just kind of put on layers of tan. I really enjoy the process of.
Well, you know, increasing melanin, which is what gives us that pigment in our skin, increasing melanin. I told you melanin.
Yeah, you said melanin and DHA both.
That also allows you to take in some light and use it rather than it burning. So we have to build up that melanin. That's what changes the color.
Because you're basically storing that light.
In water. So what happens is sunlight and many different forms of energies. Melanin is a really fascinating molecule. Melanin can take that light and use it to dissociate water. And what I mean by dissociate water, it changes water into oxygen, hydrogen, and in the process, it makes 4 electrons from that. So we're getting electrons. We're getting energy directly from that. We're also getting oxygen from that, which is what the mitochondria use. We're also getting hydrogens, which is what the mitochondria use. That's how important water is in being hydrated, and it's how important sunlight is so that melanin can have these effects.
That's really interesting. So being tan is essentially providing a supply potential energy.
So is DHA, the photoelectric effect, which is what Einstein, light can be transformed into DC electric current, and that's what DHA does.
Getting a little low on time here. Anything other than the light hygiene and the, you know, the way you approach food that you think is like significant lever to pull for someone?
I mean, grounding is a big deal. Be grounded as often as possible. That's free electrons right there. I think that avoiding toxins as much as you can, all the artificial fragrances and heavy metals and all these different things, you know, pay attention to your exposure from food, water, cosmetics, cleaning products, air, that kind of stuff. Like, you know, minimize it as much as you can. You're never going to avoid it all. So don't try and avoid it all. And don't get frustrated when you can't. Like, just minimize your exposure to those things, because those are just interfering with natural biological processes, whether it's biochemical or biophysics, and the ability of structured water to form on itself. So avoid the toxins. And then I think it's very, you know, useful to, you know, manage stress. Is such a, you know, generic way of saying it, but it's like when you look at stresses that negatively affect our health, it's the stresses that make us feel like we're out of control or we're in unpredictable situations. And so if there are stresses like that in your life, do your best to mitigate those. Like if you have stress because, oh, you're busy or, you know, but you have control of those stresses and like, it's kind of like a good stress, you know, like don't, those are fine. Those don't have a negative impact. According to the research, it's the stresses where it makes you feel anxious or like you don't know what's going to happen next, which sometimes we can't get, sometimes that's a person in our life that we can't get rid of, you know, but you know, toxic relationships, bad work environments, just things like that. Like those are the stresses that you need to try and get rid of, that kind of stuff. And then putting your body into these other states where you're grounded, you're in sunlight, circadian rhythm, proper diet are all making you more coherent and resilient to those stresses that you can't.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about stress and stress management strategies on this podcast. Lastly, from an exercise standpoint, I mean, you exercised hard the morning of or the day before your heart attack. I mean, we know exercise is obviously a stressor and also can be really good for you. Is there a certain type of exercise or energy system to you think focus on is just more in line with kind of harmonizing with how these structures actually work, like how our cardiovascular system works? And if we're trying to put like cardiovascular disease, I think is still number one killer. Like if we're going to hedge to avoid a disease, that's the one to prioritize. Is there like, should we look at exercise, you think, as what's the most you can do with the least stress imposed from it? Or is there a certain energy system you think is more worthwhile focusing on?
I think that's a good way of putting it. Like, what can you do to maximize the benefit and minimize the strain and the stress on the body? Yeah. Which is why I like things more like, I guess people like HIIT workouts where you're doing, it doesn't have to be as intense as some people, but, you know, you're just doing a short-term stress on the body, which is kind of intense, but you do it for a short amount of time. There's a really good book
called... And you're in control. It's voluntary.
Right, yeah.
Which has a different hormonal profile later, right. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, than the fear created from being out of control, yeah. But there's a really good book called Body by Science where, and it's, you know, Dr. Doug McGuff, and he's been studying this with his clients, like, and his patients his whole life in his exercise lab, and he gets the same benefits from, you know, 15 to 20 minutes in the gym doing, you know, three different exercises to failure, one set. He gets the same benefits or sees the same benefits of people than being in there for an hour and doing three sets and of different things, you know. And that's what I do today. And I actually gained some muscle mass doing that. And I think that's very, very important. Like, what we should focus on, especially as we age, is maintaining our muscle mass. And so that is, you know, resistance training, that kind of stuff. Like, challenge your muscles a little bit. You don't have to be a big bodybuilder or anything like that, but you need to have some muscle and you need to maintain that. So that's just putting resistance to that. Like, you know, if you've got no upper body strength and you're just running all the time, that's not healthy for the heart. You know, like some cardiovascular, like 3 to 4 miles of running a few times a week is fine. But excessive miles, I do not think is healthy for the heart. And I talk about that in my book and how it's actually been shown to increase scarring of the heart and that kind of stuff. But maintaining muscle mass, being generally active as much as you can throughout the day, even that's just going for walks or being up and moving around rather than just being sitting. And if you have to sit, that could be a standing desk, like something to just keep your body a little more mobile.
Stephen, I really appreciate you coming on today. Understanding the heart, surprising insights into the evolutionary origins of heart disease and why it matters. Fantastic book. I'm not through the whole thing, but I will get through the whole thing soon. Going away for a few days, so I'm just going to bring it with me and finish it off. I know you mentioned before we hit record, you got another book on the way, so maybe you'll come back on. Do you want to tease that for a moment?
Yeah, this one is centered around pain. You know, once the whole opioid epidemic started a few years back, I kind of picked this up, and you know, pain is what I deal with on a day-to-day basis, and there's a lot of misunderstandings about pain and how pain is signaled in the body. And the different types of chronic pain that we can get. And so I kind of flesh that out in this book from a very biophysics perspective, a lot of the things we just talked about now.
Well, I would love to have you back on to talk about that. I have some people very close to me, my family, that have dealt with where pain is just such a big part of their life. It really dictates their quality of life. And I know there's a lot of people out there like that. So looking forward to that. Thank you again for coming out. Want to keep on track and respect your time. And for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. And if you know somebody you think would be interested, please share it.